This was the backup version, wasn't it?
Linoleum knife. Okay, so here's the thing. This has now happened twice.
Yes.
For this theme song?
Yes.
And then also for the Linoleum Knights theme song.
Right, which is a different piece of music.
And I'm wondering if...
The player is dying?
Is the player dying?
Well, don't throw the disc out. Howard has offered to make us new ones. So if the new ones also don't work, then we know it's time to kick this.
I don't know. You know, I really like these. I like the glitchy versions. I'm sort of into it.
I don't think it's fair to our friend Blue, who composed this for us.
But it's still fun.
He did not sign off on the remix.
My name's Dave White. I'm a film critic for The Wrap.
This is
Who are you?
I'm Alonzo Duralde. I'm the film critic for The Wrap, and
you're the film reviews editor for The Wrap.
Yeah, but
and
okay.
The main film critic for The Wrap. Come on.
Sure. Yes.
Say all of the beautiful things that you are.
And I'm the co-host of the Breakfast All Day Maximum Film and sometimes Deck the Hallmark podcasts. And this is Linoleum Knife, by the way. I don't think we ever said that part.
I did. I said Linoleum Knife. Oh. That was the first thing I said.
Okay. It's a podcast of the cinema.
Stop being discombobulated.
If you're joining
and
us.
And get ready to be great at being a film critic.
Well, I don't go in for experimental music the way you do. So it's got me off my game. Anyway, we're film critics and we're husbands. And that's the
right
point.
That's the plot of this film.
Yes.
Let's just tend to some piece of business, production business, before we continue. I have a great idea.
What's that?
And I want to say it now so that I don't forget it.
Okay.
Here's what I want you to do. I want you to say, mic check in three.
Oh, my God.
Wait. Mic check in three, two,
okay.
One. That way I will know that you are ready to do a mic check instead of just having to read your mind.
This is something
How
we
about
talk
that?
About in a production meeting and not during the program.
This is a production meeting and a podcast.
No one cares.
At the same time right now. This is what I require.
I don't care what you require. We're not talking about this.
I
right
can't
now.
Read your mind about the mic check. I can't just you staring at me is not the same
when
as
I say
let's
we're
have
doing
a mic check.
I say we're doing a mic check. You act like I'm sneaking it up on you from nowhere, like boo, it's a mic check. No, I've said, okay, let's do a mic check, and then you're like coughing or doing whatever.
Coughing.
And then
I was coughing.
And then you're looking at me like, what? And I'm like, it's mic check. That's like I told you. It's
I'm telling
check.
You the way things need to be.
Oh,
need to
okay.
Be.
Okay, fine. I will learn calligraphy and engrave you an invitation so that Lord Fluffenfold knows that it's time for a mic check if he can be bothered to come down from Mount Poopy Pants.
Thank you for coming to my production meeting in the middle of this podcast.
God.
Otherwise, how are you today?
I'm
spouse.
I'm just dandy.
Current spouse.
Oh. Okay.
I've had that in my head for a few days because there was some article written about some famous dude. I can't remember now who it was.
Mm-hmm.
I'm blanking on the identity specifics. But the article actually said he met his current wife. Blah, 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 like in the south of France or whatever. And I'm like,
yikes. Was she like number four or something?
Yes.
Well, okay, then I think.
Quite literally the fourth one.
That might.
She am number four.
Then maybe you don't get too attached anymore.
But what if the fourth time is really true love for life?
Maybe if you're a journalist, you don't learn the new spouse's name because you've seen what happened to the last three.
Remember the friend who's still a friend? Who would just like date dude after dude after dude. And after a while, you and I said, we're not going to bother to learn their
names. Oh, yeah, no, there was no
point.
Until
they're around for at least 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were all substitute teachers, basically.
Because every time we would hang out with this friend, we would have to ask someone else in the room, wait a second.
Is this the same one as
is
last
time? Is this the same one as
no?
last time?
Okay.
Is there a, what's his name? Yeah. I've had that. He met his current wife in the south of France for about 5 days now.
I'm your once and future spouse.
Hilarious. About yeah, no kidding. Please. I found the... Let's just be real. Husband jackpot. I have it. I hit the husband jackpot. That's something a friend of ours tells me all the time. And he, as though I need to be told this.
That y'all are ridiculous.
And like he's reminding me. And I'm like, no, I already know that.
I came out okay in this transaction.
You really did. I'm making you some corn on the cob.
That's right.
For dinner tonight.
Although that is really one of the few things I know how to make. So don't get too proud of yourself.
No, I'm not saying I'm proud. I'm saying that it's that time of the summer.
Yeah, well, it is
when
that.
Corn on the cob. If you have enough ears of corn, mm-hmm. that's an entree.
Oh, yeah.
That's all you need.
In fact, you know what? You should gather together the, you know, queso blanco and the mayonnaise and the hot spices to make some elotes while you're at it.
I don't know if mayo is part of the deal all the time. I know when Martha Stewart made it, it was. But
are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting that there might be a real way to do this that she was adapting.
I'm trying to remember what the kind at Veggie Grill was. Not that they're the last word on authenticity either. But
I don't think they are.
No.
We have some movies to talk about.
We do. But it's warm. Our thoughts turn to corn on the cob.
Right.
And stone fruits. It's summer.
I'm sorry. If you say stone fruit one more time, y'all don't understand, you listeners, what I'm dealing with here. It's as though someone came to him in the night and whispered into his ears, have dreams of stoned fruit. Like, I every time you say it, I'm hearing Elizabeth McGovern in Downton Abbey saying it, ooh.
A dessert
of stone fruit.
And it's, you sound like somebody doing Ed Sullivan.
Comes out of your mouth at least once a day, and I'm like, will you shut up with the stone fruit? We got nectarines, we got peaches, we ate them up. The CSA box is coming again on Wednesday. There's going to be more. You got some plums showing up here. You can calm down. There will be no dearth of them.
I'm using a collective term. I don't know why that's such a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing, but I got the memo.
I'll just call everything a pluot. How about that? Is that what you want?
I got the memo.
Everything's a pluot.
Everything
now.
You need is coming.
Look, I hate summer. This is one of the few things, one of the few corners that I find pleasurable.
This is why we're good marriage material, because we both hate summer.
Yes.
And we also hate the Suicide Squad.
No.
No, we don't. You hate it. I hate it more than you do, but you...
I didn't hate it.
Okay. I don't hate it.
I was generally entertained by it.
Just not... I'm not having all the feelings that you had about it.
Well.
The feelings or the thoughts or the
okay, well, anythings. Look, first of all, I grew up reading comics, and I read the original Suicide Squad comics when I was in college.
Is that when they happened?
That's when they started.
In the 80s?
Late 80s.
All right. That makes sense, because they're cynical as hell.
Yes.
And that... jibes with that whole
that
80s
era of
atmosphere.
Post Dark Knight Watchmen stuff. And did you see the last one?
Suicide Squad? The one with the same exact name as this one?
Practically, yes.
Yes, I saw it and I didn't like it.
I didn't either. So this was a pleasant surprise given how little I was into the last one. The last one, which we can no longer blame on director David Ayer, because he's all like, that was not my version. That was what Warner Brothers wanted to release. He's like, I that ain't me. I got a cut somewhere that I'd like to put out sometime if people Snyder me up. But like what you saw in 2016 was not my vision.
Someday I want to hear someone yelling, release the Claire Denis cut.
Claire Denis always gets final cut.
That's true. She's Claire Denis. What's wrong with you, David Ayers?
She's operating for much smaller budgets, and she's not working for, you know, Warner Media, a division of AT&T.
Make your bed, lie in it. I'm kind of kidding.
The catty O'Tourist.
Kind of not. Tell me what Suicide Squad is about.
Okay.
I already know. I saw it.
Yes.
But tell the people.
Sure.
So, the people have a right to know.
So Amanda Waller, Viola Davis, once again, is assembling Task Force X to do an awful thing that has to be top secret. And if they succeed in their mission, they'll have like time taken off of their life sentences. If they die, they die and no one cares. And if they try and go rogue, the explosive device that she has implanted in the base of their neck will explode.
Yeah.
So immediately you can tell that James Gunn has learned from what didn't work in the 2016 version.
Yeah.
The 2016 version, like the first, what feels like half an hour is Viola Davis explaining who all of these characters mm-hmm. are.
This time, is a two-film franchise.
Yeah.
About an overworked woman who is constantly disappointed by her employees.
That's fair. So she is, you know, they basically plunge you right into this first mission. They barely tell you who anybody is or why they're there or what they can do. And it doesn't matter, frankly, because most of them die immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out, they were actually the diversion for the other squad
right.
that we're spending most of the movie with, which includes Idris Elba as Bloodsport, John Cena as Peacemaker, both of whom are like deadly crack assassins, but Bloodsport is cynical and Peacemaker is idealistic and dumb. You have...
Well, I guess I won't spoil what else he is.
Yeah, he's a lot of things.
All right.
You know, you have Ratcatcher 2, a young woman who can control rats. You have the Polka Dot Man, who is a ridiculous character who actually... The film eventually allows you to take him a little more seriously by the time it's over, both for what it turns out his abilities actually are and how he got that way and what it's done to him.
Yeah.
And King Shark, who is a possibly an ancient shark god who can walk and talk and is also really dumb and voiced by Sylvester Stallone.
But sort of kind-hearted. In his dumb way.
Ultimately, yes. When they convince him that they're his friends and he shouldn't eat them.
Yeah.
He is the Groot of this movie, basically. James Gunn, of course, did the two Guardians of the Galaxy movies. Marvel fired him for a hot second when old tweets surfaced. They hired him to make the Suicide Squad. Then Marvel forgave him and took him back, but let him make this movie anyway. So, you know, win-win for James Gunn. Yeah, I thought that this movie was pretty fun. It does slow down at moments where like you kind of wish the pacing were a little peppier, because when it's happening, when it's popping, it's really funny and really takes full advantage of the R rating in terms of the violence and the language and the general pervading cynicism of it all. You know, it gets into some political areas that I think other DC movies would never, at least certainly not the Zack Snyder ones. Wonder Woman 1984, I think, also went in that direction in some ways, in a way that was kind of cool. I thought this movie had a fun energy to it. You know, Margot Robbie is back as Harley Quinn, and, you know, she's a blast. And, this felt to me like the perfect balance between James Gunn doing Guardians for sort of a wide audience and then the really bleak and didn't really work for me super, his like R-rated superhero parody.
Yeah.
You know, this, I think, kind of hits on all cylinders. And, you know, it would be great if he got to make more of them. If they're going to go down this well, I would much prefer this kind of colorful and, you know, hard-bitten and intentionally grotesque and funny take on superheroes than the super solemn Zack Snyder version.
Right.
What's your beef?
I don't really have a specific one. When you say it touches on political realities. Mm-hmm. You're right, but I don't think it cares about them.
I mean, not only in so much as they're a plot device. It's a
backdrop.
Yeah.
That is based in reality.
Yes.
Like this was shot. The exteriors were shot in Panama, and it's set there.
It's set in the fictional Corte Maltese.
Right. But part of the plot involves, you know, American intervention in Latin America.
Yes.
Reminiscent of what we did with Manuel Noriega. You know,
right.
The United States.
Propped up.
The United States employed him to, you know, fight communism and battle the Sandinistas. Set him up to be what he became. Then we took him out.
Yeah. I'm not saying this movie is like, you know, the Battle of Algiers.
No.
It's not about...
You're so right.
It's not the Battle of Algiers. No, I'm not saying it's necessarily about those things, but it does at least touch on them and include them as part of the overall, you know, tapestry.
If you, you know, want to learn more about American interventionism and the destruction that it has caused globally, you could just Google it. You'll find out so much, not just Panama, but everywhere.
In fact, I'm going to go ahead and say my DVD pick of the week, or my streaming pick.
The Battle of Algiers.
No, it is from the same director, however. It is Burn, starring Marlon Brando, also from director Gio de Pontecorvo. Okay. And it is about William Walker and the how the United States will prop up revolutions just to get a better deal on exporting sugar or whatever.
Right.
It is from 1969 and still feels super relevant.
Bottom line, the United States is a terrible imperialist country.
Yes.
And we say this knowing full well that we were born here and we are part of it. And
we benefit from that.
And and that's not what this film is really about. It just uses it as a setting for entertainment. And I that's kind of a rock in my shoe when that sort of thing takes place.
Would you rather they didn't? I mean, don't you think it at least sends the average superhero person who might not know about this kind of thing down a path of thinking about what the U.S. presence in other countries is and does?
No, it doesn't make anybody go down that path unless, you know, really amazing film critics like us talk about it.
Well, thank God for us.
Here's what I liked. We can talk about the kaiju?
Yeah, it was in the trailer. And
it's everywhere now. People are talking about it all over the place now. Kaiju.
Yeah. Star of the Conqueror.
Got some kaiju.
A DC villain I've been wanting to see in a DC movie for a long time.
It is reasonably funny sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
It is extremely violent in a CGI way, but still an inventive CGI way.
Yeah.
So, you know, you get to watch people's heads sliced open and stuff, and
faces get blown off.
If this were a Roadrunner Coyote short, it's that kind of violence. It's extremely cartoonish. I enjoyed specific characters.
Mm-hmm.
I think Polka Dot Man is really interesting, and his performance guy's name is someone I don't really...
David Dastmalchian?
David Dastmalchian or Malchian?
Dastmalchian, I thought it was told.
I liked him.
Yeah.
I liked Daniela Melchior,
mm-hmm.
Portuguese actress who plays Ratcatcher 2. Idris Elba doesn't have a hugely interesting story, I think. But, you know, he's the anchor. he's the star, he's the big guy in the movie.
I'll say this, I could see this opening the door for him being a certain kind of action star.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Who is entrusted with the occasional sort of one-liner or world weariness.
Oh, he's solid and he is world weary and he's really good at both of those things while being extremely handsome.
Yes.
Idris Elba. Do you know who the on-set King Shark was?
It was a Steve Agee?
Steve Agee, yeah.
Right. Well, because, you know, Sean Gunn is the weasel.
Yes.
And he's always doing mocap in his brother's movies. But I'd read that Steve Agee, and Steve Agee actually has like a major dialogue-y role as one of Amanda Waller's sort of lieutenants. I think he's supposed to be the warden of Belle Reve in this also. And if you stay through the credits, there's the implication that we'll be seeing Steve Agee again.
Mm-hmm. I'm a big Margot Robbie fan.
Mm-hmm.
I have not yet been a big Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn fan.
Okay.
Until this film.
Really? Not even Birds of Prey?
I might be the one person for whom Birds of Prey just didn't move me in a huge direction.
Okay.
It was fine. When I say these films are fine, DC superhero films, Marvel superhero films, I'm telling you that I go in, I watch them, I have a medium good time to a very good time watching them, then I forget them. This is the same conversation that we had when we talked about Black Widow however many weeks ago. I don't feel anything for them. They don't excite me. Occasionally they have in isolated moments. Nothing here excited me.
Okay.
And I feel like if I'm going to watch an R-rated children's film, then I should be excited in that manner.
Okay.
Okay. To that end, I felt more real humanity coming from Harley Quinn as a character this time around.
Huh. Interesting. I'm wondering if that's because something that's specifically different about this film, or it's just a matter of cumulative impact where, you know, you've seen her do this thing enough times and it is now landing with you. I don't know. Who knows?
Interesting. Perhaps. I was kind of stoked that Pete Davidson was going to be in this. I like Pete Davidson.
As soon as he walked on screen, I was like, oh, this... You're going to be one of the ones who dies in the first 15 minutes because there always is in a Suicide Squad movie. A
little bit stoked that my Australian garbage movie boyfriend, Jai Courtney, was in this one too, again, you know.
Returning. It's returning. Captain Boomerang.
Yeah. As opposed to my Scottish garbage movie boyfriend, Gerard Butler, who has yet another film coming out very soon.
Of course.
I can't remember the name of it, but it looks stupid. I'm... very excited about
that. They yell cut on one. He gets in a car. They drive him to the next set. Like, he's never not making these
movies. This one, it's the end of the world. In this other one,
To save the president.
You have to save the president. In this one, you're a guy who's a dad and plays soccer, but then we're going to go back and put you in another Save the President movie as soon as you're done with this one. You're filming the soccer dad movie in real time. You'll be finished in 90 minutes.
And then in this next one, you have to save the president or the world will end.
Jai Courtney is actually, outside of this context, is proving himself, I think, to be something of a character actor.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately for him, happens to be in the body of a super hot person.
I think he's, with any luck, he is going to go through the Colin Farrell path.
Right.
Of like, okay, you...
He needs to, because he is in terrible film after terrible film.
Yeah, exactly. You've made me the handsome leading man in all of these garbage movies, and you're killing my brand. How about this? How about I get to be, make me frumpy, make me a supporting character, make me not lovable by the audience, and let's go do that. And
obviously, that's a longer path, and it means less money-ish.
Right.
Sort of.
But it means a longer career.
But it means a longer career, and you won't wind up in a Hallmark movie. You know?
I'll tell you. Honest Thief. Did you, I don't know if you saw that one. One of the yeah. 10 Liam Neeson
last year. Last year was on.
Yeah.
Jai Courtney was on TV last year.
Yeah. Jai Courtney is really fun to watch in Honest Thief, which is a mostly forgettable movie. But his crooked cop in that film is like, he walks away with the film. And it's like, yes, more of this. More like supporting bad guys where you just get to be the most interesting person in the movie.
I've started to take notice of Joel Kinnaman as a human being, because until recently I had not. He's been in a lot of movies.
Right.
But I don't, he doesn't stick.
I've been the same way.
With me. And I think very much like Idris Elba in this film, he is this very solid solid action guy.
Yeah.
And that's good for him.
And I think in the Suicide Squad movies, he is very much the straight man.
Yeah.
In terms of like all the wacky stuff that's going on around him, he's very like, you know, head down and, you know, focused on the mission or whatever. He does a lot of TV stuff that we haven't watched.
And then of course there's the star of the film, Viola Davis. It is her franchise. She is the overworked woman for whom all her employees are screw ups.
Yes.
Yeah. I think this is fine.
Okay.
It's fine. Sometimes it's funny. Sometimes it's violent in a way that I like. Individual performances are making me happy here and there. That's it.
Fair enough.
I don't feel like I have to think about it too much. And after we turn off this microphone today, I will never think about it again.
And that's actually true. You will not.
I will have to be reminded.
Which one was this?
What the names of the first two Suicide Squads were. And if they're smart, they're going to call the next one Three Suicide Squad.
Or A Suicide Squad.
The Suicide Squad.
N Suicide Squad.
You saw a documentary.
Yes.
Called Enemies of the State.
Yes.
I have not seen this, but you should talk about it.
Yeah, and I'm going to be real vague because what I liked the most about this movie was not knowing where it was
going
to go.
I unfortunately know where it's going.
Yes.
Because you watched it last year for some reason.
Toronto, I think.
The Toronto Film Festival. Yeah. And when it was over, you said, let me tell you all about this movie that I just watched. Blah, 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 blah. Huge spoiler. And I thought, okay, well, that just means I don't have to watch it now.
Fair enough.
So that's what I'm doing, not watching it now.
So, yeah, this is a documentary directed by Sonia Kennebec. Apparently, I'm looking up my review, and it says that I reviewed this out of Sundance 2020.
So not
Toronto.
Toronto.
Anyway, it's now in theaters and streaming. And it's about the DeHart family, this guy, Matt DeHart, who had been in the Air National Guard. Investigators start ransacking his house on an accusation of child pornography. He insists to his parents that he is the victim of a cover-up, that he actually has damning information about the FBI investigation to a CIA operation. So, you know, it's a your classic, you know, kind of WikiLeaks thing where they're trying to shoot the messenger and discredit him and whatever. Right. And so, you know, they talk to his parents and they get their side of the story and how they kind of like have to go on the run and figure out where they can be safe from the authorities. They talk to the authorities who are coming after this guy and explaining what they're about. And you get this, it sort of weaves together this story where you're not entirely sure, like, is this a cover up or, you know, is this guy guilty of what they say he's guilty of? Mm-hmm. And it pushes it back and forth in a really interesting way. And it's just kind of one of those documentaries that they very much, you know, the whole notion about like documentaries are never objective, you know, like the, you know, news is never objective 100%. That's always going to be sort of colored by the point of view of the journalist, the point of view of the filmmaker. Things are being edited. A storyline is being assembled for you to take in. And this movie is kind of throwing you both options and making you understand why either one seems plausible from the outside based on what we know. And then it all kind of winds up in a way that's, you know, that I will not give away. But this is a really provocative documentary. I think it has a lot to say about how people get information on the internet and what makes them convinced that they have the whole truth about something when maybe they don't, and how things can be made to sound very convincing while they maybe aren't. That's certainly an ongoing problem in this country. Like, now you've got all these people who are convinced that, you know, the science and why I'm not getting vaccinated because blah, 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 you know.
Right.
And so the movie, I think, really uncovers, you know, without stopping and telling you that's what it's doing, is sort of showing you this is how people go down these wormholes, because if you get all of your information from these sources that already believe this one thing or that believe that other thing, then you're going to come out the other end believing that other thing, right, and somehow convinced that you've gotten the full story.
Yes.
So I'll leave it at that. But I will say it is a fascinating documentary and people should see it.
Well, even though I know the big secret, maybe I'll watch it someday.
Maybe you should. I think you would.
I'm saying maybe.
I think you would find the film, it, like our dear friend April always says.
I know.
It's not about what happens.
It is, I agree with her.
How the story is told.
We say this on the show all the time.
Exactly. So I think you would find it interesting from the point of view of the filmmaking of how they accomplish what they accomplish.
But at the same time, I had to watch Brigadoon.
You didn't have to watch Brigadoon.
Oh, no, I had to.
We voluntarily watched
Brigadoon. I had to watch Brigadoon for my life.
Yes.
We did. It is not my DVD recommendation of the week. Because it's, I mean, I think people should see it because it's just so weird.
I had never seen it. I'd always heard about how it was the sort of victim of this economy drive at MGM where they didn't shoot it on location. They did the whole thing in sound stages.
That I love. And yeah, then I can't get enough of fake nature on a soundstage in a 1950s musical.
Yeah, but I think
it's the best.
In this movie, it's almost Uncanny Valley.
It's super uncanny.
Because, like, you look at something
uncanny,
like...
Uncanny weird.
But, like, yeah. But like you look at White Christmas, and you know that they're in a soundstage. You know there's a roof to this, like, sky above the inn.
Yes.
And the little stream that's going by it.
The matte paintings in Brigadoon are so good.
But, yeah, so, like...
you...
like White Christmas...
That for a second you think, wait a second... Are they actually outside now? Oh, wait, no, they're not.
There's enough artificiality in White Christmas where you go like, okay, I see what we're doing here. Right. This is just an old movie.
Right.
But Brigadoon gets so close to the edge that it's disconcerting. And then also, poor Gene Kelly had to choreograph a movie in CinemaScope on a soundstage. So he doesn't have that much far back to go.
Nope.
Because it's not like a Busby Berkeley movie where, like, it's just this endless stage.
Right.
No, there's a hill behind you.
Yeah.
So you have...
Oh, there's a hill that you're under.
Yeah.
It's an uneven surface. And everyone's like jumping over rocks and bridges and stuff. And you're like, oh...
So you have to, he has to,
dancing is weird
here. He has to choreograph, like, all these long, flat dancing sequences. Oh, God, it was, I feel justified in having never seen it before, and now I wish I hadn't.
No, I'm glad I did, because now we understand Schmigadoon
a little bit better, I suppose. So.
And also, we have something to tell our friends about. Have you ever seen Brigadoon? It's crazy.
Yes, our journey through classic musicals that one or both of us have not seen before continues.
Let's talk about Swan Song.
Oh, yes.
The new film from Todd Stevens,
mm-hmm.
written and directed by Todd Stevens, who made Edge of 17.
He wrote Edge of 17.
He wrote Edge of 17.
He wrote and directed Gypsy 83 and the Another Gay Movie.
Yes. So he wrote and directed this. He shot it in his hometown of Sandusky, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
It is set in Sandusky, Ohio.
Yes.
And
based on a real person from
Sandusky.
Other
films also set in Sandusky? Is this his John Hughes-y thing?
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, Edge of 17 was shot wherever King's Island is. That's, I think, where movie, at least the first part of that movie is shot. He's a very supportive filmmaker of his
hometown.
Good on him.
So this stars Udo Kier.
Yes.
And Jennifer Coolidge. And Udo Kier plays
Mr. Pat.
Mr. Pat.
Who is a real guy.
A real person.
From Sandusky.
Yeah. In the film, he is referred to as the Liberace of Sandusky, Ohio.
To which he responds, am I that butch?
When we meet Mr. Pat, he is in a nursing home, and all of the glamour has been stripped from his life. He is wearing white Velcro sneakers and sweatpants, and he sits in a recliner, and he smokes more cigarettes.
The brand more.
Which is against the rules.
Yes.
At the nursing home. And he's just waiting around. He doesn't do much. News of the death of the richest socialite
in Sandusky.
Of Sandusky comes that she has passed away. And in her will, it stipulates that he is to do her makeup and hair for her funeral, should she die before him. But he doesn't want to do it because they had a falling out years ago.
She left him for a former employee who became a rival hairdresser who drove him out of business, played by Jennifer Coolidge,
who, by the way, Jennifer Coolidge's performance in this film is not like other Jennifer Coolidge performances that you have seen, because there is nothing wacky about her. She's just burnt by people and not having anyone.
There is a coiled rage to her in this film that's like nothing I've ever seen her do. And we're watching The White Lotus
where she's giving another amazing performance.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a huge fan of hers for years. Arguably the hardest I've ever laughed in my life was at a show they used to do in L.A. called Beverly Winwood Presents the Actors Showcase.
It was a Groundlings show.
A lot of Groundlings alums were in it.
Performed every once in a while.
And they would rotate what the different sketches were, but the premise was that everybody in the audience was ostensibly a casting agent or a talent manager or a casting director, and we were there to see this Beverly Winwood's acting school, to see her students performing scenes from well-known plays and like films.
Yeah.
And
when the show was over, they would come out to the lobby and like hand you their
headshots.
Their headshots and stuff.
And schmooze you in character.
Yeah. And you would have to be like, why is Paul Rubens talking to me? Yeah.
So the showstopper of the night, I think every time I saw this, they did this sketch. There would be like a young woman and a guy who was a very experienced actor, and the young woman was part of this school doing a scene from The Glass Menagerie. The lights would come up and the young girl would immediately run off stage, and you could hear her like violently barfing off stage.
Right.
And then a voice would come over the speaker and say, the role of Amanda Wingfield will now be played by so-and-so's mother.
Fern Magnon.
Thank you. And out would come Jennifer Coolidge in like a mini skirt and heels and like lots of makeup and lots of jewels and like clearly like just the supportive mom, you know, like stepping in at the last moment, not knowing any of the dialogue and sort of improvising. I can't begin to do it
the
justice.
The most deranged thing I've ever seen her do. Maybe the most deranged thing I've ever seen anyone do. But yeah. If you live in Los Angeles and this ever happens again,
oh man,
and they get her to come in and do it.
Run, don't walk.
Because it doesn't matter how many times you see her do it. And we saw her do it about three times.
At least.
Because every time they would do the Beverly Winwood show, we'd be like, they're doing Beverly Winwood. We have to get tickets again. So anyway, back to the film.
Yes.
They offer to pay Mr. Pat $25,000 to do the hair and the makeup. And he says no. Then he changes his mind.
Yeah.
And he busts out of the nursing home and he walks to Sandusky, because the nursing home is a few miles outside of the city.
Yeah. He gets picked up by a hitchhiker. He hitchhikes.
And
holding a sign that says free beauty tips.
He spends the entire next like 2 days drifting from place to place in Sandusky, revisiting his life.
Yeah.
And some of it is quite sad, and some of it is very darkly funny. He runs into some young gays who he has no understanding of.
And vice versa.
Anymore, and they treat him similarly. He runs into some old friends. Those encounters are unusual as well.
He runs into Jennifer Coolidge.
My favorite moment, he goes to his old house. It has been torn down. A new house has been built. A new family lives there. And he talks to them. And he talks about how, you know, when his partner died in the, like, 90s.
Yeah.
The partner's family came in and just took everything.
Yeah.
Everything they had accumulated, all the beautiful things that they had accumulated over the years as, you know, self-styled, fancy in a small town gays.
Right.
Gone. And the young woman in the couple says, "Well, I guess it's a good thing that can't happen anymore." And Udo Kier says, "Yeah, great." Then he walks away. Like, he is so perfect.
Yeah.
In this film. Exactly what you need this character to be. I will forgive the schmoopy, sentimental ending, which I did not care for, because he is so great.
The ending is...
He is so simultaneously cutting and moving.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing to pull off.
For sure.
Yeah.
I think the ending pushes it, but it didn't push it over the brink for me.
It did for me.
What I love about this movie is it is often very funny, but at the same time, there is this undercurrent of poignance throughout, in a, because they're talking about a generation of gay men that we don't get to see a lot in movies.
No.
The ones who survived the worst of the AIDS era.
Yeah.
You know, the ones who came around who, like, you know, paved the path for the people who, like us, got to be legally married.
Right.
You know, all of the stuff that gay people get to enjoy now. The notion that, like, he always did the rich socialite's hair and never attended one of her parties.
Right.
You know, because it just wasn't done. And it was understood that he knew his place and she knew her place, and that's just how things were.
Right.
As
we watched it, I reminded Alonzo of the Halston documentary.
Yes.
Where, back when Halston was not, before he was Halston, you right. know, he would work with these very rich New York socialites. And then they would invite him to dinner parties, and more occasionally than not, their husbands would refuse to sit at the table with him because he was queer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I love the story that's being told here and the way that Stevens captures it without being mawkish about it. He's very straightforward, and, like,
yeah,
there are dudes who are this age and this is what they lived through and this is, you know, what they did, you know,
to get by.
Yeah. And then how they made it through. So, you know, I love all of that stuff. I love the sort of picaresque nature of how he sort of picks up, like, hats and outfits and things
right.
along the way. How he, like, will shoplift things that he needs to when he
right.
needs to. There's a scene in a consignment store
yeah.
that almost brought me to tears
yeah.
because the woman working there had gone to him once, and eventually he totally remembers everything about her
right.
and how he made her look and how he made her feel. And it's a lovely moment.
Yeah. And then there's Linda Evans as the corpse.
Yeah.
And that's all I'm going to say about it, because it's really, interesting what happens with this character, both physically and
emotionally,
performance-wise. Yeah. So, I recommend this.
Yeah.
I didn't care for the ending, but I overall, I'm into it.
I would be shocked if Udo Kier doesn't get a Spirit Award nomination.
He better.
And I hope Jennifer Coolidge gets one too.
She better. Listen, I'm throwing down the gauntlet. Independent Spirit Awards.
You heard?
Yeah. Vivo. What in the heck is a Vivo?
Vivo is...
I didn't see it.
Apparently, we haven't all had enough Lin-Manuel Miranda in our lives.
I know I haven't.
For the last 12 months.
Listen, I like him. I just, what happens when people get hot suddenly is that then they're everywhere. And after a bit, you think, how about...
Let me miss you.
How about we take a break? Yeah.
Like, Jennifer Lawrence, very brilliantly, has like been gone for... What, a year now? A couple years?
I'll tell you what, I didn't need a break from her. I think she's really cool.
No, I think she's great too, but still, I think she was ubiquitous. And
she was ubiquitous.
Before we got tired of her, she like ran off, and she's coming. Yeah. I know she's going to be in stuff soon.
Okay.
So it's like she's very canny about that kind of thing. Lin-Manuel Miranda, I think, is just delighted to be asked.
He's everywhere. He's everywhere at once.
Everywhere.
He's in this apartment. Hiding behind the chair over there. What's his face on Tim and Eric? Spaghetti! He's going to jump out from behind.
He's writing raps about podcasts. Vivo, Lin-Manuel Miranda, I believe, did the music and performs. He plays the title character, who is a kinkajou. He lives, a honey bear from the rainforest.
Okay.
He lives in Havana with Andres, who is a... a skilled guitar player played by Juan de Marcos Gonzalez, who is part of the Buena Vista Social Club.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a lovely life. They go to the plaza and they sing and Vivo dances around and they
do
pass
they pronounce
the hat.
It plaza in Cuba?
Some Cuba there.
I know this is a you and your family.
The Cubans I grew up with. Yeah. Often operated with the Castilian accent. Okay. But I'm not going to speak for all Cubans.
Just wanted to know.
I am Castilian.
I use the th, so
everybody calm down.
I'm very calm.
Anyway, Andres gets a letter that his one-time love, Marta, who's voiced by Gloria Estefan, is going to do her final. She left. They used to perform together. She went to America to become a recording artist, became a big star. She's going to give her farewell performance very soon in Miami. And he has written a song for her that he never gave her, and he never professed his love to her. And so, he decides that he and Vivo are going to go to Miami so that he can deliver it. There are complications, and ultimately Vivo is in Miami and needs the help of a young girl to deliver this song to Marta. The young girl is one of the big miscalculations of this movie.
Okay.
It's not the performer's fault. The character is just really obnoxious, and you're meant to adore her nonconformity and her, she's different and she's extra and she keeps it cranked up to 10. And it's like, okay. Oy, oy, oy. Also, like, this is a movie that, starts out in Cuba and it looks really great. But the last third, half to third of the movie is this like crazy chases through Key West, through the swamps, to like, who's got the song and who's going to, is Vivo going to get eaten by an alligator, to get to the big finale finally. Yep. And it's just like, oh God, I got real tired of it real fast.
Hmm. Is that it?
Yeah.
Is that all you have to say about Vivo?
It is one to skip unless you're really...
Little kids going to dig it, maybe?
Little kids will probably dig it because it's frantic.
Okay.
But I found it rather wearing. But if you're, if you are an LMM completist, there it is.
Okay. Hey.
Hey.
Let's talk about Pray Away. Oh, wait. Before we talk about Pray Away,
yes,
you saw Annette, the new Leo Carax film.
I did, but we're going to wait until you see it. If you're dying to hear what I have to say about it, go listen to Breakfast All Day. We will talk about it after it premieres on Amazon Prime on August 20th.
Yes. So here's how this is. The reason this happened is because you and I have self-imposed, isolated ourselves again.
Yes.
Because of that Delta variant.
Mm-hmm.
We are vaccinated, but things are kind of weird out there.
And A close friend of ours who was vaccinated. Just came down with COVID, like symptom-heavy, feeling like crap COVID.
So that bothers me, and I would prefer not to have that go on.
Ditto.
In myself. And so we have stopped going places.
Yes.
Annette is currently playing in local movie theaters.
Mm-hmm.
It will be on Amazon Prime streaming on the 20th.
Correct.
And when we come back from our 2 weeks away.
Yes.
At the end of the month, which is coming up soon.
Mm-hmm.
Because the middle of the month is this coming weekend.
Yeah.
So after we do
the next episode.
We're done for 2 weeks and we will be back at the beginning of September. When we come back at the beginning of September, we will talk about Annette.
Great.
Okay. Now, in the meantime, let's talk about the new documentary on Netflix called Pray Away from,
Christine Stolakis.
Thank you. I was on the Swan Song page and not yet on the Pray Away page.
Why don't you
but I'm gonna fix that.
Sum this one up since this is a movie about your people.
All right. This is a movie about my people. Those wacky evangelical Christians that I grew up with. Now, if you've been listening to this podcast for any length of time, you know my story. I don't need to rehash it for the millionth time. But if you would like to hear it rehashed from two different angles, I was a guest on two different podcasts talking about this very subject. One of them is called The Sewers of Paris, hosted by our friend Matt Baum.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of a how punk rock saved me from being an evangelical in the 80s. The other podcast I was a guest on is called Good Christian Fun. And that was an episode entirely devoted to one album by the former contemporary Christian pop singer Leslie Phillips, who is now recording and performing under the name Sam Phillips. And honestly, she recorded as Leslie Phillips for about 5 years in the 80s. And then in 1989 was like, nope, done.
A blip on her brilliant
career. On her brilliant career. Because since 1989, well over 30 years, she has been recording astonishingly good music as Sam Phillips.
Yes.
She was the music supervisor for Gilmore Girls, in fact.
She did all the strum, strum, la, la.
Strum, strum, la, la, la. That was her. So, okay. Anyway, I was on Good Christian Fun talking about that album and my own
history
in the context of that album from her. So, for the purposes of this program today,
we'll take that as read.
Yeah. I grew up evangelical. It wasn't good. It was very bad. And then in 1989, I got the hell out. Lucky me. So this is a documentary about the ex-gay movement. And they talk to a lot of people, including some of the people who were sort of the founders of it.
Yeah, of Exodus.
People in the 70s who went to a church here in Southern California who were gay, and they didn't know what to do about that. So they formed a little support group for each other because they didn't want to leave the church. They didn't want to stop. They didn't want to get, and they certainly didn't want to come out and get kicked out. They wanted something in the middle. They wanted to stay where they were, receive the support of the church, and resist being sexually active as gay people. They also, over time, decided they wanted to figure out a way that they could perhaps live within the structure of the evangelical church, which is you better get married and have kids or you'll never hear the end of it. Some of them did, some of them didn't, some of them just stayed celibate. But the goal, as you hear from many of the participants, including a man named John Polk, who very famously was a nationwide spokesperson for, was it Focus on the Family?
Family Research Council.
One of them.
He and his wife, Anne, who were both, he had supposedly come out of being gay. She had come out of being a lesbian. They got married. They had children.
Had a couple kids.
They were on the cover of Newsweek. They were trotting around to talk shows. It's like, look, it's possible.
Look at what you can do. Yeah. He's in this film.
Yes.
She is not.
No.
She is still in the evangelical church.
Yes.
They talk to him, and he talks about everything that he went through. And with an emphasis on his, in his own words, shame and embarrassment at who he was for them. Because what the original group Exodus wanted to be and what it became exploited for and became powerful doing was lobbying for legislation that was explicitly designed to make the lives of queer people miserable and dysfunctional.
The overall idea here is, why give these degenerates their rights when all they have to do is come to our church and want it enough and they can be freed of this sin?
Right.
That, you know, that gay is something that you are, it's something that you choose, and we can fix it for you.
Right.
And so you shouldn't get anything in the public sphere because you're broken and we can heal you.
The word broken is something that you hear a lot in the film. And I remember as a young person hearing that word a lot to describe everybody in their, what is known in the church as your natural sinful state.
Right.
That you are a broken soul and you need Jesus to heal your broken soul. You were born with a broken soul. And you eventually, as a child, you begin to display sin and that brokenness, and then you begin to understand what you are, and then you can understand that you also need Jesus. But they don't treat queer people exactly the way they treat other people that they call sinful. Because very frequently in the context of this film, you'll hear archival stuff. And these arguments are the ones that are used then and still used today. They say, well, you know, why should we give equal rights to murderers and pedophiles and people like that? And the
comparing it to alcoholics, you know, thieves or whatever.
You know, yeah, people who rob stuff, whatever. And what they're really saying is,
being gay is like murdering something.
It's a special kind of bad. Mm. You know, it's one of the worst things that you can be.
Yeah.
So it's not the same as the sin, I'm putting out the air quotes here, the sin of, say, gossip or envy or greed. Mm-hmm. It is the sin of sex. And because it is sexual, because that's all they see it as. They don't see it as a way of being. They don't see it as a human trait. They see it as a sexual act. Because for them it is a sin of sex, that means it's worse. Because you're disrupting what they think a family should be.
Mm-hmm.
And you will never be able to be a part of that, that thing that God wants you to be a part of.
Right.
So it's a whole tangled mess of everything. And they get you and they make you, you know, join their little groups and pray and pray and pray and pray and hope that you can change your sexual orientation. And if you can't, you don't believe hard enough.
Right.
You don't have enough faith. You're not letting God work in your life well enough if you can't fix what you are.
You didn't clap loud enough. Tinkerbell's dead.
Yeah. There's a guy in this movie. They show you him at the very beginning, and a few more times in the middle, and then he's the last shot.
Yes.
Young man, whose name I cannot remember off the top of my head now, but it's not, doesn't really matter. You see him at the very beginning of the film, approaching people coming out of a grocery store or a Target.
Yeah.
And he's got a sign, a handmade, homemade sign, very, very homemade sign. And it says, trans to Jesus, something like that.
Yeah.
And he describes himself as ex-trans. And he shows a picture of himself when he was, in his words, when he was transgender, and a picture of himself now. And he will go up to anybody coming out of any store and just start talking to them about it. That's something that back in the day when I was really young, in the 70s, they called that street witnessing. You don't see it very much anymore. But it was strongly encouraged back then. You know, we're going to go out tonight. We're going to win souls. We're going to go to the mall and win souls at the mall. We're going to go to the carnival that's visiting town. We're going to win souls at the carnival.
But this isn't even like the guy with a sandwich board and a loudspeaker. This is one-on-one.
One-on-one. You're approaching, you're cold calling strangers.
Yeah.
I never participated in it because it seemed terrifying and ineffective. Like, I remember the rate
of return is not great.
Thinking,
I'm sure,
to myself, if I were just coming out of the record store and some stranger walked up to me and wanted to talk to me about
anything,
I'd be like, what are you doing? Get away from me.
Stranger.
Get away. Yeah. But this guy will do it easily. He is out there to get the job done. He's organized a thing called Freedom March, which they sort of bill as sort of the next generation of Exodus in terms of its... Yeah.
It's the antithesis of a pride parade. It's basically all these quote-unquote ex-gays marching for their whatever. Yeah.
But one of the things he says in the film is that, you know, the older generation, the Exodus people who are sort of all leaving Exodus, and Exodus itself is gone.
Yeah.
He's like, well, they did it their old person way. Mm-hmm. We're doing it a new way for the new generation.
Yeah, so he's got a Facebook page.
But they're not. It's the same old story in, you know...
contemporary trappings.
With pink hair. It's not a... There is literally nothing new about what they're selling.
There is a heartbreaking moment where he takes a phone call from a woman who calls, having seen the Facebook page, to talk about her trans child.
Yeah.
And the advice she gets is terrible.
Yes.
And just, you know, and that's what folks like this are out sharing with the world, like with some sense of authority. And it's appalling and it's tragic.
When I came out to someone in my church in the early 90s, and the person asked me if I had considered going to Exodus.
Right.
And I said, no, I have no intention of doing that. And then this person asked me if I had been abused as a child.
Go.
And if that was what had caused it. And I'm like, ma'am, this is an Arby's. Like, I said, no. Then I wrote the person a letter. And I said the following, and this is something I actually say on the Good Christian Fun podcast. The burden of change is not on me, it's on you. You hear me say I am gay, and suddenly you're allowed to stop listening to me because the devil has taken hold of me. You know, the evil one has triumphed in my life, but that is not the case. What has come about in my life is my awakening to the oppression and cruelty and abuse that the church dishes out routinely to queer people, going so far as to advocate and lobby for legislation that would further harm my life. So, if I am not the person who is best suited to explain my life, then who is? It ain't you, and it ain't Exodus, and it's no one else involved at the church either. I know who I am. You need to listen to me. I am not they. I'm still one of us. because you're my friend. And that's that. Now, you said the heartbreaking moment was the young man on the phone.
Well, a with heartbreaking
the
mom. Moment.
But every moment he's on screen is heartbreaking because he's young. And he's very savvy as an activist.
Mm-hmm.
There's even a quote that he gave to a Christian website that I read where he said, "I was innocent as a dove and cunning like a serpent by agreeing to be in this documentary because I want to reach people." Mm. And so it is possible that he is reading reviews of this film. It is possible that he's listening to podcasts where people talk about this film. And so I will say this, young man, if you happen to be listening to this podcast for whatever reason, if you Googled it and found us and you're listening to this podcast, I want to tell you something. As an old man, I am 57 and I've been through it. I've been through exactly the environment that you are in right now. And I had people tell me over and over and over again that I was broken. You are not broken. There is nothing broken about you. Are you trans? I don't know. That's for you to decide. But you're queer. You're part of our family. The people who are currently exploiting you and using you, they don't care about you. At all. I hope someday you have your awakening to this.
Pray Away is now streaming on Netflix.
After I watched it, I posted the final shot of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yes.
On Twitter with the final girl, Sally, in the truck, shrieking with laughter and covered in blood.
Yes.
And that's how you feel when you finish watching this movie, if you got out.
Yeah, I mean, I have a bit, yeah. I have, thankfully, that's not part of
you
my...
You and I have seen all these documentaries about the ex-gay movement and about, you know, queer activism and everything. This one's getting more noise around it.
Yeah.
Because of Netflix,
It's
on Netflix.
Ryan Murphy is... I'll tell you, for as much as we've disliked a lot of Ryan Murphy's Netflix originals,
that's true.
He has, I think, somewhere in his contract. Like, by the way, once a year I get to do a queer documentary, and so we had Circus of Books, we had A Secret Love, and now we have Pray Away, and all three of those films are terrific.
Yeah. So, yeah, like I say, it's not the first one of its kind.
No.
We've seen a lot of them over the years, but somehow this one's getting the traction that the others didn't. The other ones seemed always to sort of stay put in the queer film festival world,
yeah,
and not make roads outside.
Yeah, I mean, like For the Bible Tells Me So got some distribution, this is a thing where, like, if you weren't looking for those movies, you weren't going to find those movies.
I know y'all didn't go see Boy Erased.
Yeah, well,
that wasn't a documentary, but like. People are watching this because I'm reading about it all over the place. If you are queer and you came from this environment and you don't want to watch this documentary, you don't have to, because I've also read that people were very sort of like upset by it, by the things they see. And you would have every reason to be upset by it.
I mean, were you?
No, because I don't have any feelings left.
Fair enough.
I'm an old person. I'm a geriatric Gen Xer who's had it. Nobody hurts my feelings anymore. Nobody makes me feel bad about myself. Bring it on. They don't have that.
Hardcore.
What does Susan Hayward say in Valley of the Dolls?
She doesn't have that. She doesn't have that hardcore like me.
Yeah. I got it, baby. Remember?
In this business, they come left, right, and below the belts.
What does the grandmother, what does the aunt say in Oklahoma? You need to be ready for a lot of things to happen to you in life. You need to be hardy. Well, if a lot of things happen to you in life and you're not hardy, I would like to give you a hug. But me, I'm
hardy.
I'm a cockroach.
Fair enough. We have a letter. Oh, do you have a DVD pick?
Yeah, Brigadoon.
You just said it wasn't going to be your DVD.
I changed my mind.
Fine.
Watch Brigadoon. It's weird as hell.
See if you can guess the one scene that Pauline Kael said Vincent Minnelli had fun making.
Yeah, there's a scene close to the end in Brigadoon that is manic, and it's not set in the world of Brigadoon. It's set in another part of the world.
Yeah.
And it's wild. And that's all I'll say. You should, yeah. Go look at it. It's part of history.
Yes. Take in all of Sid Charisse's Scottish accent.
Oh, God. The Scottish accents. I don't think there's a single Scottish person in the film.
I think some of the supporting players are.
Barry Jones is British, but...
And enjoy Van Johnson's coded gay performance.
Oh, my. Drinking the whole time.
From the actual gay Van Johnson.
Katie. Hey, guys. I wanted your thoughts on late-to-you discoveries. This week, my husband and I have watched two Judy Holliday movies, It Should Happen to You and Bells Are Ringing, and I feel cheated that I did not get to this amazing actor sooner. She was always a name I was vaguely aware of, but somehow hadn't made her way into my life until now. So what's something you discovered late and were mad at the universe for somehow withholding from your life until then? I agree with you on Judy Holliday. I just think she's the best. And Bells Are Ringing is another weird musical that people should watch because it's about technology that not only no longer exists, but will baffle most people who are watching it now.
What's an answering service?
Do you know my mother used to work for one in the 70s?
Oh, wow.
They had them until...
Well, my dad used to have one in the 70s because he was a doctor.
Yeah.
I never get mad at myself. I'm just like always open to things because I know that there's so much stuff that I don't know about.
Yeah.
Like I've read enough about film where like there are names floating around that I know I should be on top of, that I need to catch up with their work, and eventually, ideally, I will. So to me, it's always just been a process of like, finally, you know, Ida Lupino or Dorothy Arzner or something like that, where it's a lovely revelation. Like, I don't think I saw a Jacques Demy or a Jacques Tati movie until the 90s.
Yeah. That's probably true for me, too. Yeah. A film critic that I'm super a big fan of, Nick Pinkerton. Mm-hmm. I read on his Substack recently about the Cinema da Boca do Lixo, Brazilian underground film movement of the past, like, 40 years.
Okay.
It translates to something along the line of cinema of the garbage mouth.
Okay. Tell me more.
Something like that. These wild sort of gonzo films from Brazil of the time. Not the Cinema de Novo.
Right.
But this other movement.
Okay.
I had never heard of it before.
I'm hearing about it for the first time right now.
And I love being taught new stuff. So, yeah, that's my answer.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we have one more letter from Shadi.
Ah, yes.
And I don't know if she intended to have this read on the air or not, or if she was just like sending me a letter, like, because she sent it right to me.
She sent it to Linoleum, too.
Oh, did she send it to Linoleum podcast as well? Not just my personal email? Okay. Yeah. Anyway. David Alonso, two things. Number one, Matt Damon. I do not mind apologies from celebrities for homophobic behavior they have displayed in the past, as long as that apology comes with $1 million check for a worthy cause. That is, thank you, correct.
Sure,
that is correct.
Yes. And GLAAD doesn't count. Like, they do some good work.
GLAAD does not count. And number two, sorry, but I feel like you guys took Jungle Cruise a little too personally. And went a little hard in your review of this mostly PG romp. I mean, it almost sounded like you were angry at Dwayne Johnson for not playing a homicidal gay basher.
Yes. You've seen right through a Shoddy. That's exactly why we didn't like Jungle Cruise.
Okay, but here's the thing, right? As I said, if and that gay had been open about being a gay at that time in history, they would have put him in prison or killed him.
Okay.
And now maybe Dwayne Johnson's nice Jungle Cruise boatman would be nice to him. Maybe. I mean, obviously there were some nice people back in the day. But it's just sort of like, I don't want people to think that history was like this.
No, no, obviously
that's
not.
That's my whole thing.
Also, I'm figuring no one's actually learning any real history from this movie, so that didn't bother me as much. Like, yeah, it's a thing that's nonsense, but it's a Disney movie, you go with it. But there's so much else to loathe about this film that did not get in the way at all.
Hang on, she continues. She goes, the fact is that Emily Blunt is still simply unflappable. Agree. Fully agree. Dwayne Johnson's sexual charisma works best only when he is playing against other bald-headed, muscular men.
That is true.
But I still enjoyed his playful Tracy and Hepburn detente with Emily Hunt.
I said this on Twitter, and I stand by it. If anything, The Rock and Emily Blunt in this movie are Richard Chamberlain and Sharon Stone in King Solomon's Mines. And that's as good as, that's as high as I'll go. Tracy and Hepburn.
She says, Paul Giamatti and Jesse Plemons are giving performances that befit a cartoon on the back of a cereal box. And I wish Jesse Plemons, who spends the entire movie in a giant metal phallus surrounded by seamen, exchanged a few glances with Jack Whitehall before the end.
I hear ya. I think also this movie probably figured that they couldn't have a gay villain on top of everything else.
I live in the OC. I wouldn't be surprised to hear Disney is the largest employer of LGBTQ people in the world. That is, I bet you that is almost fully accurate.
A case could be made.
Final review. My 5-year-old son liked it.
Well. If you had had an empty refrigerator box, it probably would have entertained your 5-year-old for longer than Jungle Cruise did.
Oh, and I forgot an entire sentence from this letter.
Damn.
You know, I get rolling through the letters and sometimes I skip lines and I think, and then at the end I think, oh wait, you skipped a whole chunk of that letter. I do this. Y'all don't know. I do this pretty much every week.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Sorry, everyone.
Maybe you should have never told me.
Wait, here's the line I forgot to read.
Okay.
Regarding Matt Damon personally, I am more offended by the fact that Hollywood took the Amanda Knox story and made it about a middle-aged white man. And surprise, it's tanking at the box office.
Yeah, the best you could say is that that and The Suicide Squad are double features about, like, American imperialism and how we take sensitive situations and make them worse by blundering in.
Right. Okay. Have we done a good job at being film critics today?
I believe we have.
I think so.
All right, so this week, rather than salute a fellow podcast, our theme song composer, Blue, who did not write the version that you heard today because that was the CD messing up, but he is, as I always say, a very talented musician. He has a new album out. It is called Six Tape. And if you are one of the, I have not checked to see if they've all been sold, but if you're one of the lucky people, you can snap up a limited edition of this new release that he's actually putting out on a VHS cassette with videos for all of the songs. It's all very exciting. But anyway, check it out. There's various different formats and versions you can purchase. And I'm a huge, huge fan of his music. And we love the fact that he has let us use this wonderful ditty as our theme song for years now. But if you can go to blue.bandcamp.com, check out Six Tape, check out his other stuff that's on sale there. He's great and you'll like it. Subscribe to this show at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review. We'll read it on the air. You can also leave positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Spotify and Google Play and Amazon Music and Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, CastBox, Podbean, etc. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com.
We've
come to the end.
It's time to make dinner. I gotta get in that kitchen and
make.
I got a job to do.
Okay. Yeah. Well, until next time then.
Goodbye.